Welcome to Behind the Story, a program where we take you straight to the source. Eric Robinson is a middle school teacher in Denton, Texas, but he's also an avid baseball fan who's done extensive research on the history of the Negro League here in Central Texas. In this episode of Behind the Story, we talk about Waco's most well-known Negro League team, integration, and what Robinson sees as the legacy of this era. Robinson will be in Waco talking about this history on September 19th at the Emergency Services Education Center on Steinbeck Bend Drive. Eric, thanks for talking with KWBU today. What was it that first got you into baseball, and what made you really dive into a historical analysis of the sport?
Well, I really don't know what got me into baseball. I've just always been a fan from the first game I went to, from watching it on TV, from playing it, it's just always been something I really liked. I practically learned how to read from the back of baseball cards and just kept on reading more and more baseball books from there. And just over the years, I want to say interest waned, but as I went to college and became an adult, just didn't have time for it like before. But then by my late 20s, was reading more and more baseball again, and with a deeper, more historical perspective and outlook on it. And then I had an event in the summer of 2012 that took several years to diagnose fully and correctly, but I ended up having heart problems, which triggered at least one stroke and just made it real difficult for several years for much activity to happen at all. And after several months, I just got tired of sitting around the house and watching TV and watching movies, and was just trying to think of things I could do that involved me that I could do sitting down that would still be productive. And I realized, man, I like reading baseball history. I seem to be coming across new and interesting things. Also like writing. Been enjoy writing whenever I have to for, work or personal reasons. Let's just combine the two. So then I just turned my reading about baseball into researching about baseball and then writing and presenting the information I found.
How did you get started with these presentations?
The area I started with was Austin area Negro League baseball. And I read the right combination of books where I noticed something that I'd never really seen published directly. And I even talked to some authors and historians, and they knew a lot of the generals, but they didn't find that specific stuff that I just happened to chance upon. And mainly it was just the number of star players that had played on this one team in Austin, who there is very little records of officially. And so I just started reading and focusing my area of research on that, and then just growing from there. My first actual presentation was with this group in Austin called Nerd Night. And it's pretty much like a TED Talk, but without the headset microphones, and it's at a bar, and, heavy beer drinking is encouraged at it. And it's really through some of that beer drinking that encouraged me to submit my idea to present at some point. And I submitted to them, sort of forgot about it. Several months later, they asked me if I wanted to present. And I said, sure, and went for it. And I was happy with the results and have just gone more from there. I've presented at schools and even at the Sabre National Conference in 2014 in Houston since then.
Now, Eric, what made you look at the history of the Negro League, and more specifically, the Negro League here in Central Texas?
What really attracted me to the Negro Leagues, and especially the ones in Central Texas, were these were teams and players who were walking in the same neighborhoods I was walking in 100 years before me, same streets. Some of them had even made it to the Hall of Fame, and you don't hear anything about them. It's a level of talent that has just become forgotten. And I know some of it's time, where it's not even just based on, racial attitudes of the day or written historical records, but, when you get down to it, not a lot of baseball players from 1915 are getting discussed in, the public discourse right now. But there was just so much more baseball history in Central Texas than people realized. And in a way that sort of excited me, like in the sense of discovery, you know, like still finding new things, like, oh man, didn't realize that this guy played for the San Antonio team. Oh, that's amazing. That's something else to add to the note pile. And then also frustrating because this should be a known thing amongst sports fans.
What is it about Central Texas that all these greats are coming from?
So many greats came from Central Texas. For a reason, there's still so many great athletes that come from here. Weather. It has weather that lets them play more, a climate that encourages activity in more months a year than, say, New Hampshire or Oregon or Idaho might, and just a competitive spirit. Something that helped the African-American players of that day were that they were also allowed to play on the same fields that the white ball players in their towns got to play in. That really didn't happen in many other cities and states. So the players from Texas, they weren't just playing in fields that were marked off, just little corner lots. They would be able to play on the same fields the, you know, the big star Texas League teams were playing on, but just on the days they'd either be out of town or not playing due to, you know, typically having Sundays and Wednesdays off for church.
So Jackie Robinson, the first African-American to play in the major leagues of the modern era, had Central Texas ties. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. He spent 1944-45 as the athletic director at Houston College in Austin. But prior to that, he was stationed at Fort Hood during World War II. And he went through a situation that actually attracted quite a bit of attention at the time. He was an officer. He was a college graduate from UCLA that was riding at the front of the bus for military members. And the local bus driver in Killeen asked him to get to the back of the bus because he was black. Jackie Robinson argued, and correctly given the rules and standards, that as a military officer, he did not have to give up his seat. And the bus driver then had him arrested. And Jackie Robinson ended up getting discharged over this incident and the jailing and the argument for refusing to give up his seat and move to the back of the bus for being black.
And what was Jackie's career path after this event?
Well, after that, he went home briefly. He hated Texas, really didn't care to come back, but one of his best friends and a mentor of his was the head of Houston College in Austin, and that's now Houston Tillotson University, and asked him to come and be the athletic director. And it was there, while working as their athletic director, he worked out, kept in shape at local gyms and ball fields, you know, became friends with Hilton Smith, who is from the Austin area and a member of the Kansas City Monarchs. And that spring decided to go down to the Houston area to try out spring training with the Kansas City Monarchs. He played baseball in college, but it was his third best sport, so he really hadn't paid much attention to it afterwards. And, well, after that season, there's several pretty good movies about that out there.
In the early 2000s, the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame began a 100-year study on African-American players from 1860 to 1960. This was all an effort so the Hall could start looking more closely at recognizing the history and legacies of the Negro League?
The first Negro League player inducted into the Hall of Fame was Satchel Paige in 1971. And through roughly the year 2000, they had, and I forget the exact numbers, so you have to forgive me, but had several dozen or so players from during that time that were inducted in, Josh Gibson, Rube Foster, Willie Wells, other greats. And then I believe it was in 2006, 2007, they formed a committee to just to be like, all right, which players have not been elected in yet, inducted in, that should be here. And that committee itself, they inducted another roughly 10 to 12. And again, I forget the exact numbers off the top of my head.
When specifically talking about race relations of the time, outside of occasionally sharing a field, what was the interaction like between these two leagues?
A lot of times, the interaction between the Negro Leagues and the White Leagues would depend on the time, the place, and the situation. There are barnstorming games and exhibition games during the off season between black and white teams were common. It wouldn't be uncommon in certain areas, usually more in the North or the Midwest, where you could find semi-pro teams that would have black and white players on them, like in North Dakota, Michigan, Minnesota. And then you also hear stories. A lot of times they don't know whether they're rumors, stories. A lot of them I do think are true, where in the offseason, certain black players, Rube Foster and work with John McGraw, Christy Mathison of the New York Giants being an example, working with players and teams, but just could not get any attention or credit for it afterwards. They were going to remain separated, no contact. So there, like so much of history, especially when you're dealing with a complicated situation as racial relations, there is just no real simple answer for how it was during this big chunk of time. I have read somewhere, this was said in regards to Jackie Robinson, that baseball integrated America. And while I do feel that overly simplifies so much, I do believe in a big sense there is an element of truth, at least in a pop culture sense, in that statement.
Can you tell me a bit about Andy Cooper, who he is, and this presentation you'll be giving?
Okay, at this upcoming presentation, I'm just going to do a little bit of the basics of just the Waco Negro League teams, Texas Negro League teams, and not really so much their success or failures, but just their difficulties, and same difficulties a lot of teams had that have barnstorming teams come through, like Kansas City Monarchs, the Chicago Leland Giants that played Waco. But really, I'm going to focus on several players, including Rube Foster, Will Foster, Crush Holloway, and Andy Cooper. And Andy Cooper, I believe, is a very interesting person because he had such great success as a pitcher and a manager, has been elected to the Hall of Fame, yet there's so little known about him, so little talked about him, where I feel that he is potentially the Hall of Famer that is discussed the least, that is least known in the public mind. He was a left-hander, and he was number two in all-time wins amongst the official Negro League stats, and that's above even greats like Satchel Paige and Joe Williams and Hilton Smith, and had a successful managerial career with the Kansas City Monarchs as well. And yes, passed away relatively young, and that was that. And it's a shame for someone that was that talented, that had a career as a manager and a player as he did, and it's just, pretty much become forgotten. I mean, for example, he's selected into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, but he has not been selected into the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, which is roughly 3 miles from where he's buried now.
Is that common for African-American players to be accepted into the Hall of Fame but not to gain recognition locally?
No, it's not common. I mean, players of that caliber, if they're recognized nationally, they tend to also be recognized locally, regionally, and most places in between. There are other contemporaries of his that were players that, have been elected to both. There are even other players that are elected into the Texas Sports Hall of Fame that have not received, Baseball Hall of Fame credentials, to bolster it, their cases. And I don't think it's any willful neglect on the part of the Texas Sports Hall of Fame. I think it's really just a lack of recognition and knowledge in general that happens with players like Andy Cooper.
Eric, Can you talk to me a bit more about the Texas Negro League teams, especially those here in the Waco area?
Maybe the most influential and important Negro League team to come from the Waco area was the Waco Black Yellow Jackets. And a lot of that was just due to the involvement of one player, pitcher Rube Foster. And he was a man who went on to have a career as one of the top Negro League pitchers in history. And in the early days, you know, arguably the top pitcher. And so he got his early start, you know, here in Waco, and just led that team to great success with playing series in San Antonio that would draw so much attraction. The trains would run special deals and promotions back and forth between the two cities. Other than that, there were other teams, including like Waco Black Tigers. And another prominent Waco team was the Black Cardinals. And they existed in the late 20s, early 30s, and were a member of the Texas-Oklahoma-Louisiana League, the most successful of the Negro leagues that played in the Texas area. And these Texas Negro Leagues were never official in the way that the, you know, the ones in the North and the Northeast were, but they still had a high level of play. They just had problems sustaining and lasting more than 1, 2, 3 years at a time. And another interesting fact about the Black Cardinals were in 1930, they played a game at Katy Field against the traveling Kansas City Monarchs whenever they came in town as well.
When we're looking at the actual size of the two leagues, were they comparable to one another?
The amount of teams, that could be interesting and sort of depends on the area and at the time. Like in the official Negro leagues, like the Negro National League, the Negro American League, they had fairly consistent cities, teams, and owners. Yes, there would be some turnover, but that happened, you know, in Major League Baseball as well, just a little more so in the Negro Leagues. Really, in a lot of the other ones, and especially in Texas, there was so much turnover and so many problems. Just attendance varying. You might have 700 people at one game the next weekend against the same team, have less than 100 people at the game. So every year, every time there tried to be an organized league, they would have more teams at the beginning of the season than at the end. A lot of the teams also in the Texas Negro Leagues were an outgrowth of semi-pro town teams. And that's just where towns, the best players from each town would sort of loosely start assembling and associating with each other and then start playing the other towns till it got more and more competitive. The better one of these would, these teams would then start barnstorming and just traveling to play outside leagues, might actually be playing official Negro League teams, might be playing teams from companies. They might be traveling to Mexico to play. So whenever you talk about a Negro League team outside of the official Negro Leagues, it's really going to be a semi-pro barnstorming team for all intents and purposes and consideration. Mind you, they might have the talent level of an official Negro League team, but also maybe not. There is just quality varied greatly team to team, player to player.
Now, barnstorming, I've heard you use it a couple times already. What exactly is it?
Barnstorming is just traveling and playing whoever, whenever. And there would be teams, you'll hear stories, that would play three games in three cities against three different teams. It might be against, you know, a similar semi-pro team. It might be against a local school or college, or could it be against, you know, any variety of teams. There were even teams like the Indianapolis Clowns who dressed like clowns and would have clown skits and routines in the middle of their games. And this would even include future Hall of Famer and one-time home run champion Hank Aaron, who got his career as an Indianapolis Clown performing clown skits as well as hitting home runs.
So was barnstorming a pretty common practice for the leagues of the time?
Barnstorming was very common in those days. Really, the biggest thing that took barnstorming away were gas rationing in World War II. So it took a hit during the Great Depression. Gas rationing in World War II made it even harder. And then after that, the interest just pretty much waned. Really about the only example of barnstorming we have left is the Harlem Globetrotters. But just imagine, instead of just playing gimmicky basketball, just teams playing their sport. However, yes, they quickly learned that gimmicks attracted customers and they got paid at the gate. And, you know, so a lot of gimmicks were incorporated, but that wasn't necessarily incorporated into every game.
And what's the benefit or the reason of going to play anyone you can? Is it for more practice, for the love of the game? What's the real benefit here?
The benefit for barnstorming was pretty much purely financial, to just play places other than your home stadium. You know, there was no radio deals, no TV deals, no endorsements. So the only income they made was from the revenue made at the admissions from the gate. So the more games they could play, that was the more tickets they were selling and the more money they made. And to play new teams, you know, that was a part of it as well. But that's how they had to pay their way.
In the research you've done, what's the most fascinating detail or aspect that many people might not know about the Negro Leagues?
I think maybe the most fascinating thing learning about the Negro Leagues was during the off season, how much interaction there would be between Black Negro League players and white Major League players in leagues held in Mexico, Cuba, and other places, where it would not be uncommon at all for there to be a team like mixed race teams, Latin, Black, white, whoever, in the 30s, 40s, during the off season, receiving little to no publicity in the United States. You know, some with great talents assembled together, and how that's just sort of been forgotten as well. And what potentially, at least on paper, looking at some of the lineups available, could have been the best teams, you know, of that time period are playing for 2-3 months in the off season in Cuba, in Mexico, and elsewhere.
What was the exact motivation for them to play with each other and against each other?
A lot of that would be they love playing baseball, but once again, financial reasons. You know, this wasn't the days of the $8 million signing bonus for, you know, an average player. So they only got paid whenever they're playing. For the Negro League players, that was especially true. They needed to do something year-round. And for a lot of white Major League players, their salaries were at that level too, where, you know, they couldn't necessarily afford to take 4 or 5 months in the off season in the way that, say, some star players would or players get to now.
Eric, what do you believe is the key component that led to integration in baseball?
Really, the simplest answer as to what led to integration, yes, Branch Rickey was aware of what the overall effect of him bringing Jackie Robinson to the Dodgers would be. But when you get down to it, he was trying to bring in a player he thought would help his team win. And yes, there were individuals and executives like Bill Veeck with the Cleveland Indians who did see it as a bit as a crusading effort. But for the most part, they just wanted to bring in players who could help their team win. And not necessarily doing it with a social conscience while still being aware of the implications, but is he going to give us a better chance to get to the World Series and win it? If so, bring him on. We got a space for him in the lineup.
Do you believe that the love for the game and the universal language of baseball is what helped integration to really grab hold and take root in the sport?
Yes, I definitely think that having a player on your team, no matter race, creed, color, whatever, if they're helping your team win and be a success, it's hard to root against someone who's helping this institution you root for, you pull for, you plan your day around watching or listening to them, you spend your money to go and watch them, you wear their hats. if they're helping that team win, helping that team advance through the playoffs, and potentially win the World Series, win the whatever sports championship, yeah, they're not going to care too much about the things that are going on off the field as long as it helps the team win on the field.
For you, what's the importance of this history and legacies of the Negro League?
I think the importance of the Negro League history is that there were other men out there who had talents and abilities and accomplishments equal to other athletes who've become legends, who just because of circumstance of being born in a time and place that they were, have been forgotten. And as a sports fan, in a totally selfish perspective on my end from viewing this issue, I feel a bit cheated. I feel a bit cheated that I will not be able to ever know what Satchel Paige would have been like as a 25-year-old player in the major leagues. I feel cheated that whenever I'm having to compare Willie Wells and Rogers Hornsby and their numbers, that you'll never quite be able to get a clear, even comparison. And so I think it's important to just remember the Negro Leagues, to remember that there's more out there, and just their contributions. Willie Wells invented the batting helmet. Bruce Foster, you know, worked with white coaches and players to help give success to the New York Giants and Philadelphia Athletics that he will not receive credit for officially. And these are accomplishments that just need to be remembered and recognized.
That was Eric Robinson, an educator and baseball researcher. He'll be in town talking about the history of the Central Texas Negro League on Saturday, September 19th at the Emergencies Education Center on Steinbeck Bend Drive. For this and other episodes in Behind the Story, visit our website at kwbu.org.